Support for WPR comes from Milwaukee Film, presenting the 16th Annual Milwaukee Film Festival, featuring local, national, and international films, April 11th through the 25th. Tickets are at mkefilm.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Our next guest has performed in front of sold-out audiences on Broadway, playing Billy Flynn in Chicago.
Now John O'Hurley is taking the show on the road, bringing Chicago to Madison's Overture Center from Tuesday, October 1st through Sunday, October 6th.
John O'Hurley joins us now in the studio to talk about his role as Billy Flynn, as Seinfeld's Jay Peterman, and some of the other roles you may have seen him in. John, thanks for coming up here to join us.
Oh, nice to be here. Thank you very much. Made me feel very welcome so far.
All right. Well, first, let's talk about your role in Chicago. You've played Billy Flynn before. What's it like to pick it back up and take him on the road with you?
Well, he's one of the two leading men that one of the two arrows that I keep in my quiver. The other one is King Arthur in Spamalot, the Broadway musical. So I run back and forth, and I keep both the shows alive. I've been on Broadway doing it since 2005. I did the 10-year anniversary, the 15-year anniversary, and God willing, I'll be doing the 20-year anniversary, I'm sure. I love the show dearly. I think it's one of the great leading man roles in Broadway, certainly with the greatest entrance and exit.
Well, tell us what it is you like about Billy Flynn, one of the arrows in your quiver, so there must be something there that really speaks to you.
It really does. I think he's one of the most complex and interesting men that you can play in contemporary musical theater. I think, with the support of some of the best music that Candor and Ebb ever wrote, certainly the best choreography that Bob Fosse ever did, and just an intriguing story that is timeless. It doesn't matter when you do this, because it's just about the notion of celebrity, and that's what Chicago is all about. It's set to a wonderful jazz beat in a wonderful jazz time, and Billy Flynn is as elegant as could be, but he's a very dangerous man, and there's something that I also add to him, which is also a kind of paternal quality, which I think is important.
Let's tap into that Bob Fosse choreography you mentioned. All dancing is challenging to me, but I've heard from people who know these things that Bob Fosse can be challenging even for the pros. Was there a learning curve?
Well, not as much for me, because Billy doesn't have to do as much dancing as the chorus does. The chorus, you understand the Fosse and the fingers and the hands being an extension of the body, and he was kind of a predecessor to Martha Graham and all of the great dance, you know, these wonderful the contemporary choreographers and dance structure minds. They have a certain look. You always know what a Fosse musical looks like because of the structure of the way the body is held. And that's what makes this show so perfect.
It seems a shame that you don't get to do much dancing, though, being the first
right.
winner on Dancing on the Stars. Are you itching to get out there and show them your stuff?
I still show a little stuff. It's not devoid of move, but I certainly don't have to move like the ensemble does. They're little geniuses, all of them out there.
You used to do this on Broadway, same house each night. What's it like taking it on the road and you're a different venue every week?
Well, the nice part about it is, very simply, it's beautiful to have an opening and a closing night every week. It's just there's a sense of an event for it. And I think people, when you come to a town, have the sense of that event. You know, the Wells Fargo wagon is coming down the street, and if to borrow from the Music Man. And there is that wonderful sense of one week only, and you try to get in, and it creates a buzz in the town wherever we go, and it's such a satisfying evening of entertainment that it's just nice to go into a community, get to know it a little bit, and put on a great show, and know at the end of the evening everybody's going to be on their feet. It's just a great feeling. But I tell you, there's a difference between Broadway and being on the tour and the response of the show. I find the audiences on tour much more intelligent than I do on Broadway.
Especially in Wisconsin, right?
Well, yeah.
No, I just do. I think, they listen, they're quiet, they're contemplative, they have a sense of the show. And when you're on Broadway, people tend to go into Broadway for a weekend, and they'll go to see three or four shows, and you just happen to be the 2:30 matinee that they're catching on the way to a 7 o'clock show. And so their attention span is just different, because they're looking for that whole weekend rather than this one night as a special event. And I find that the audiences respond differently when it's just a single event.
Now, you were talking a little bit ago about celebrity being at the core of what Chicago's about. And, you know, of course, we can relate to modern celebrity culture, just about everybody. Mm-hmm. But if someone hasn't seen the musical Chicago, tell us a little bit about the backstory. What is it about?
Well, it's based on a true story about a young chorus girl who actually ended up shooting her her boyfriend. And in that murder, happened to hire a well-placed attorney who actually got her off by really turning her into a celebrity. And for no other reason than that, she was let loose. And that inspired this the story of Chicago, that the idea of that if we turn people into celebrities, then we expect that kind of behavior from them, albeit not murder, but we expect different types of behavior from them, and we hold them accountable in different ways than we do people with normal lives, I suppose.
And you're a celebrity yourself from your Seinfeld years, Dancing with the Stars on Broadway. What's it like being a celebrity playing in this celebrity story?
Well, as I say, it's timeless. I live a different life. I mean, I'm kind of the most non-Hollywood person you'll ever meet. When the year I won the Screen Actors Guild Award, I forgot to go. I grew up in that Spencer Tracy type of world, I guess, where you just do your work and you go home and you're grateful for it. But it is. I mean, I see certainly living in Hollywood. I mean, I see examples of bad behavior and misspent youth all around me every day, and it's sad. But that's unfortunately that's what it. That's what it brings up in our society, is that celebrity-dom doesn't go along with great behavior or a good moral code.
Now, obviously, anyone listening can hear your gorgeous voice, and obviously that's why you're on Broadway and have had, this career in part. But for me, sitting right next to you, your voice is amazing. Where did you get that set of pipes?
The pipes are calling. Well, I'll tell you, my voice actually, the PS to the story is really mine was the last voice to change in high school. I had a little pipsqueak voice all the way through my early, I would say, into 15 and early 16.
You were the boy soprano.
And even worse. It was just my little voice. It was up here like this. And I was actually in a children's theater production of Sinbad the Sailor, and I was playing the character Abu, his kind of little. It was the boy lead in the thing, but I was the boy. I mean, it was supposed to be like 10 years old. And then all of a sudden, and it was like one day, all of a sudden it went from up here to there to down here like this. And quite frankly, growing up in the late 60s, we had radio was such a huge medium back then. It was the source of all of our entertainment. Unless the occasional, Dick Clark's Bandstand, American Bandstand or something you'd see like that on television. But radio, AM radio was so important. And you had these incredible DJs that had these incredible voices. Mm-hmm. And so if you were someone like myself that was so drawn into entertainment, and I've defined myself as an actor since I was 3 years old, but you listen to these great voices and you have a tendency to want to mentor and mimic them. So I think a lot of my stylizing came really from the old DJs probably. Mm-hmm. And then I trained classically and musically in college. And so voice control was certainly part of all of that. So. I'm stuck with it.
Since 3 years old, you said you thought of yourself as an actor.
Mm-hmm.
What?
Yeah, no. In fact, when people would ask me what I wanted to be when I grew up, which is obligatory to a 3 year old, I would, with a sense of disgust that only a 3 year old can muster, I would put my hands on my hips. I would point to the black and white television in the corner of the living room, and I would say, well, I am an actor, so that's what I'm going to be. And it was the fact that I was the only one that apparently was clued into that, was a sense of mystery to me for most of my life. But ever since, I always knew from the age of 3 what I was going to do with my life. I just didn't know how to do it.
And we were just talking about your celebrated golden pipes that you have now, but you've used them to good effect also in funny ways. You've had a lot of cartoon voices among your repertoire. You were on SpongeBob SquarePants, uh-huh. The legendary
King Neptune on SpongeBob.
King Neptune.
Actually, yes, yeah.
What does he sound like?
They all have kind of a. As we were joking before, I've kind of cornered the market on arrogance and pomposity, so they don't really sound an awful lot different. They just come to me when they want a king or a mayor or just anyone that just could be an SOB. That's kind of what I do. King Neptune, what would he sound like? SpongeBob, that was quite a burger.
I love it.
You just asked that so your kids would hear it.
That,
right?
That,
yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Busted.
Well, you know, the reason I do that stuff is so that I develop a large body of work so that my son will have, my 6.5-year-old son will have something and his friends to listen to.
So when you tell him to take out the garbage in that voice, he listens.
Yeah. Hey, Daddy, why can't you just talk normal?
We're talking with John O'Hurley about his starring role as Billy Flynn in the musical Chicago and about his versatile career, singing, dancing, and acting. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or send an email, talk@WPR.org.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time.
I don't care about expensive things. Cashmere coats, diamond rings don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. That's what I'm here for.
And we're listening to a clip from the musical Chicago featuring our guest, John O'Hurley. He's here in the studio with us, and he will be in Madison and other parts of the state talking and performing Chicago. His character is Billy Flynn, and we're talking about that and his career both on Seinfeld, the cartoons, Dancing with the Stars, you name it. He's done a lot of things, and we're talking about all of it right now.
One question I wanted to ask you, John. During the news earlier, we were talking about your incredible travel schedule. You're hopping on planes. You're all over the place. If I don't sleep well, I worry about, can I turn it on for the show today? How do you get in the moment after this rigorous travel schedule? You must be exhausted. What does it take to turn it on each and every night?
Well, you just it's your job, and traveling is part of it. But I always try to do 110% every night I go on stage. And just before I set foot on stage, I always say a little prayer to myself, and it goes like this: I want to be surprised sometime tonight. And so before I go on stage, I just ask to be surprised. And if I'm surprised, then I've deepened and enriched the role. And I've done the show more than 1,000 times, and I guarantee you every single night something else has occurred to me. So over the history of the show that I've done, that I started in 2005 on Broadway, the show is infinitely more interesting, it's deeper, it's more complex, and ultimately more fulfilling for me as an actor.
So when you say surprise, you mean you discover a little bit of a facet that wasn't there
before.
There's
every night something else is new that didn't occur to me before. And it's been fast. In fact, when you were just playing that clip, I don't sing that song the way I sing it now. You just heard that off the 10-year anniversary album. I think that's what it was from. But I don't even sing that song the same way anymore. It's funny. I listen to it and I go, that's a much younger Billy.
Is that a conscious decision to sing it differently, or does it just evolve over time?
The role that I have now is a consequence of all of the things that have occurred to me in playing this character for the many years that I have. So it's a deeper, richer, much more complex character now than it ever could have been back when I started the role.
I want to ask you about something a little different. I've noticed you've written a couple of books, both of which seem to have to do with dogs.
Well, I have a new one coming out, actually, in 2 weeks.
What is the new one called?
The new one is my first children's book, and it is dog-related, too. It's called The Perfect Dog, and it's a Dr. Seuss-style treatment that I wrote last year for my son. During the National Dog Show, which I host on Thanksgiving Day. And it got about 2 million hits on YouTube, and so we've turned it into a book, and it's done quite well, and the pre-sales comes out in about 2 weeks.
So I'm sensing a dog fan among us here.
I am a big
you
dog
must
fan.
Have. I've do had you
a,
own I've, dogs yourself?
Yes, oh yes, I do. Although I'm on the road so much, my two dogs treat me like an intruder. But I've had a dog in my life ever since I was 4 years old. There's always been a dog in our house.
What kind of dogs do you have?
Right now we have a Cavalier King Charles, which is a common breed, very pretty faces. They're little love buckets. And then we have a breed not too many people know about, but I think if there is a perfect dog, it is the breed the Havanese, and they're a little larger than a Maltese. They're hypoallergenic. They're very smart. They take care of themselves. They are so bright and wonderful, wonderful family dogs. And we're so glad that we kind of stumbled upon the breed.
you host the big dog show. Do you ever think about showing your own dogs, or is that
no? That's an entire other world, and we don't have dogs that I would consider show quality. Mm-hmm. Although please don't record that and send that back to me, because somehow that will get to them, and that would just break their little hearts. But it was the dog show world is a different world, and I love doing this one thing that I do for NBC. It's now the number, believe it or not, it's the number one show on NBC. We get an audience of between 20 and 25 million. Every day, or every Thanksgiving Day, that 12 to 2 slot there, and it's their number one show. It beats The Voice. It beats everything else. It's been one of the most successful pieces of programming that NBC has ever done.
And you get to meet all these dogs, right?
We have 2,000 of the best looking dogs in America that have been, and this is this and Westminster and the London show are considered the big three. So the dog world is my world, but only for our Thanksgiving.
What do you think about the little dogs that go around in people's purses these days? Would you ever do that?
No, I'm not. I'm not a. I'm that. Listen, any dogs are wonderful companions, and they really should accessorize your life. They should add to your life as you add to theirs. And so, I'm a fan of anyone who's a fan of dogs.
Just thinking, for a traveling man, that would make it a little easier to take your dogs along with you.
Yeah, unfortunately, as I say, my dogs treat me like an intruder.
Well, I wanted to touch before we're done on your work on Seinfeld. A lot of people know you probably for your role as Jay Peterman on the show. When you started, did you know this show about nothing was going to be a big deal?
Well, the show was already 4 years, but half the run before I joined. I did the last four plus seasons there, and the funny story was I had hit my show on ABC. It was canceled the day before. And so I went out to dinner that night trying to take the cancellation as personally as I possibly could. In the meantime, Larry David's office had called my manager and said, we heard John's show got canceled. Would he be interested in this guest star role that's next? And I said, nah, I don't want to go guest star in somebody else's show. And I said, oh, I gave him that whole excuse. My manager finally said, just go have some fun and blow it out of your system. I did, and that was the role of Jay Peterman. And lo and behold, because of the great writing on Seinfeld, they turned it into something iconic. And there's not a day that goes by that I don't pinch myself.
And we have a clip of that. Let's take a listen to that, Ro.
Oh, God, I'm so sorry. I don't even know where I'm going.
Well, that's the best way to get someplace you've never been.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
Have you been crying?
Yeah, see, this woman, this manicure.
Oh, no, it doesn't matter. Why? That's a very nice jacket.
Oh, thanks.
Very soft. Huge button flaps, cargo pockets, drawstring waist, deep bi-swing vents in the back, perfect for jumping into a gondola.
How do you know all that?
That's my coat.
You mean?
Yes. I'm Jay Peterman.
And, of course, the famous character Jay Peterman, which you have a lot in common with, I hear. What was it like working on Seinfeld? I'm sure that many people ask Seinfeld, what was it like working with John O'Hurley? But in this case, what was it like?
It was, for the last 4 years, everyone had the great reverence of what we were all part of, because we knew we were playing with the championship team in the championship season. And we also knew that it was going to be one of the, when all was said and done, it was going to be one of the great shows, and certainly it was. And I would always say to anyone who sat in my office, anyone that was an extra, anyone that was just there for the day, I said, I want you to do something for me. I want you to save the script. I want you to take notes on everything that you did, what you wore, so that you have this database in your head, because I promise you, you're going to be watching this show with your grandchildren. And I said, I can't make that promise about anything you ever do in entertainment, but you will be watching Seinfeld with your grandchildren. Mm-hmm. And so it was this wonderful sense of that we always knew that we were in the cathedral when we were there, and the four smartest actors I've ever worked with.
You've got the singing, the dancing, the acting, piano compositions, I think, right? Some CDs, the authoring. What's next? That's all? Is there another realm of creative expression you think, oh, I really got to do that next?
I don't ski.
You don't ski.
I broke my leg the first time down the hill when I was 11 years old, and that will be one of the things that will never be in my bucket list.
I want to ask, with your beautiful voice and all that you've done in the performing arts, when you're home and you've got some free time and maybe you want to sing in the shower, what do you sing?
Well, I go down to the piano, and I have a really nice piano in the house, and I'll go in, and I write a lot of music. I've composed. I've got two classical alternative albums that have done pretty well on Billboard. But I don't write lyrics. And so I'm just starting to write lyrics. And so I've written a couple of songs. And so when I sit down at the piano and I'm by myself in the house, I work on these tunes. And I hope someday to actually have music with words.
Yeah, well, we look forward to hearing them when they're there. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Great to be here.
We have been speaking with actor John O'Hurley. He's starring as Billy Flynn in the touring production of Chicago. We've got a link to information about that performance on the Central Time Facebook page.
Coming up after the news, WPR's Glenn Moberg joins us to talk about Governor Walker's workforce initiatives announced earlier today. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network.
All I care about is love.
All he cares about is love.
Give me two eyes of blue, softly saying,
I need you.
Let me see her standing there, and honest mister, I'm a millionaire. I don't care for any fine attire Vanderbilt might admire. No, no, not me. All I care about is love.
All he cares about is love.
Now, maybe you think I'm talking about physical love, but I'm not. Not just physical love, there's other kinds of love, like love of justice, love of legal procedure, love of lending a hand to somebody who needs you, love of your fellow man, that's the kind of love I'm talking about.
Governor Walker and the legislature have introduced 8 bills they say will be priorities in the fall session geared toward improving the state's workforce development.
The bills would come at a cost, however, about $8.5 million in additional state spending, with another $14 million in federal matching dollars expected over the next year and a half.
Joining us now is Glenn Moberg, WPR's reporter in Wausau. He's been covering this story. And Glenn, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, hi, Veronica. It's great to be back. Hi, Rob.
Well, let's start with an overview on what these bills would do.
Well, he made the announcement today at the third annual Small Business Summit. Small business people are very, very important to Scott Walker's agenda. He was there with his Lieutenant Governor Rebecca Clefish, and he unveiled these 8 bills. And as you described, it would mean an additional $8.5 million in new state funds. And that should secure an additional $14 million in new federal funds for vocational rehabilitation programs. The entire thrust of this is workforce development, education, and training people for the new high-tech jobs that are out there. And at one point, the governor gave a lengthy address to this room full of small business people. There were hundreds of people there, and it almost sounded like a campaign event, almost like he was kicking off his reelection. He went through a PowerPoint describing the differences between the Doyle administration and what he described as a pro-business attitude of his administration. And at one point, he even said that we should be encouraging sixth graders and middle schoolers to start thinking about their careers and start thinking about how they can get training at technical colleges tied in with their high school so that they can, if they don't go on to a 4-year school, they can get right out of high school and join the workforce.
Glenn, do you think that he had his eye on those 250,000 jobs promised, or was he, you know, looking at something else?
Well, I asked him about that. And in the PowerPoint, he mentioned that he'd created 62,000 jobs over the first 2 years. Now, if you add in the 2013 figures, according to one analysis, it's up to about 90,000, which means he's about a third of the way to that 250,000 mark without a lot of time. But he put great credence in the fact that more than 11,000 new businesses have been created in Wisconsin over the last couple of years. And he thinks that those are going to be the impetus, the force that spurs the additional jobs. Now, whether he can make the 250,000 is questionable, but it is something I asked him. And why don't I just play about a 2-minute portion of that interview I had with the governor today, and you can hear him in his own words.
Absolutely. Let's hear it.
Governor, you mentioned the 250,000 jobs on your PowerPoint. It said you've created 62,000 in the first couple of years. Do you think it's realistic that you're going to hit that 250,000 figure in your first term? And if so, what do you have to do to turn it around?
Yeah, we're still focused on that. We think the numbers, it's part of the reason why the Federal Reserve Bank, I mean, this was one of the best years we've had in a couple, or summers we've had in the past couple decades in terms of job growth, according to their assessment. And so we look at it as an indicator and say, we had steady job growth, but we'd like to see it at a faster pace than we did the first 2 years. The 62,000 jobs were for the first 2 years, 2011, 2012. They don't reflect at all 2013 yet. And so we think that pace is going to pick up dramatically. And it's why today I highlighted that 11,000-plus number in terms of new businesses, because we think that's the key. It's a compounding factor, that as you see more businesses, net new business creation ultimately leads, as I say, if each of them are adding 2, 5, 10 jobs, whatever the number might be, depending on the size of the business, that quickly compounds that larger job number. And so we feel good about it. But as I also mentioned in the presentation, that's why we continue to lay out an aggressive plan working with the legislature on workforce development. We'll be laying out in the next couple of days more things on overall economic development and government reform, as well as improvements in education, all of which we will think help improve the job climate in the state.
Could you speak briefly about the importance of education and training in developing the workforce of the future?
Well, I think it's incredibly important. It's why 2 years ago we gave tools to technical colleges to more than make up for the changes in the budget. They've been using that now the last couple of years to invest new dollars in the workforce training. It's why we put $100 million in total in this budget, and why our first focus on our legislative agenda is on workforce development, because we believe in the end that you know, we have 30 to 40,000 people a week just on our Department of Workforce Development website where there's job openings but not enough people to fill those jobs with the skills needed. That's the next critical step for economic development in the state.
And that is Governor Walker speaking in Stevens Point, just about an hour ago. And he mentioned the Federal Reserve Bank. That's the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, and they have rated Wisconsin as number two in the nation for recent economic growth.
So that's some good news.
Yeah, that's the statistic that he was pointing to there. And again, you know, the whole thrust of this was workforce development. And if you break those new bills down, he's talking about smart investments, in his words, in apprenticeship training programs, vocational rehabilitation services for those with special needs, assistance for the unemployed who want to transition into new careers. But that assistance will have strings. The government is really going to be ratcheting up the requirement that people look for work. Incentives for high schools, graduating students with job-ready credentials, scholarships for high school seniors who excel in technical education courses, getting state licenses tested, trained, and to work faster, helping low-income and low-skilled workers transition into employment, and then tuition reimbursement for apprentices and employers. Those are those eight bills in a nutshell. Needless to say, not everybody is really sanguine about this. Peter Barca, who's a minority leader in the Wisconsin State Assembly, said it was far too little, far too late.
Now, I want to ask you about that, because Governor Walker, in the clip you just played, mentioned support for tech schools. Now, he has come under critics before for defunding technical schools. So where's the balance here?
Yeah, he cut the technical schools' budgets by 30%. And so his opponents, the Democrats, of course, are saying this is hypocritical. You're giving them more money, but look at all that you took away in the past. The governor would counter that what he's doing now are what he would call smart investments. But let me quote from Peter Barca, since we just quoted from Governor Walker. He says, at a time Wisconsin needs big, bold action, today Republicans announced baby steps. No amount of money spent on television ads will be able to hide the fact that Republicans have not prioritized economic recovery and job creation. They made anti-education, anti-worker, anti-healthcare, anti-women agendas their first priorities. And he said that in terms of the 250,000 jobs, the governor is trying to move the goalpost and count those jobs differently.
I see.
There you have it.
Now, Glenn, you said that this smelled to you like a campaign event and not necessarily an announcement, a press conference of sorts. So did it smell like a presidential run?
I don't know. It felt more like a run for reelection for governor.
I see.
And at one point, in fact, at the very end of his speech to these small business leaders, he said, you know, my father was a preacher, and a friend of his came up to him and said, "Why do you always preach to the choir?" And the governor said, "Because I want them to sing." And then he said to all these business people, "I want you to sing about my administration. I want you to sing about my pro-business climate. I want you to sing in the days ahead so that every voter in this state can hear you." Now, that sounds like that felt like a campaign appearance to me.
Now, there has been some back and forth about, whether Wisconsin is friendly for business, how it compares to Minnesota. How did the small business people who were there respond?
Oh, the small business people were pretty enthusiastic. In fact, they it gave him a couple of very rousing ovations. And, a lot of them, I think, are his base. He quoted another statistic. He said during the Doyle administration, 4% of small business people said the government was on the right track in Wisconsin. Now it's 94%. Whether you can trust those statistics, I don't know.
All right. Well, Glenn, thank you so much for being here today.
All right. Thanks, guys.
As Glenn Moberg, WPR's reporter in Wausau, and he was at that event with Governor Walker today in Stevens Point. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, we're having trouble reaching our scheduled guest, Andrew Coburn, right now. We're going to pick up where we left off talking to Glenn Moberg about jobs in Wisconsin, and we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. What do you think Wisconsin needs to do to create more jobs? Do you think the state is on the right track when it comes to the economy and job creation? If you had advice to give to Governor Walker, to state legislators, to a Democratic gubernatorial candidate, call us at 800-642-1234. Strike that. It looks like we have our guest coming on the line. I'm going to turn around and look at the call-in person here. Andrew Coburn is coming on with us in just a moment. He's going to talk about his brother's book. Irish-born journalist Alexander Coburn came to the U.S. in 1972, set out on a career challenging some of the most powerful people and institutions in American politics.
He chronicled 18 years' worth of stories and experiences in a new book, putting the finishing touches on it just days before he died of colon cancer last year.
The book is called A Colossal Wreck, a road trip through political scandal, corruption, and American culture. We talked to Alexander's brother, Andrew Coburn. He's a journalist and author. He wrote the introduction to A Colossal Wreck. Andrew, welcome to the show. Andrew, welcome to the show. Are you sorry, I don't think we had you up there.
Can you hear me?
I can, yes. So talking about Alexander Coburn, reading through his work in this new book and in the past, it struck me that this is a journalist who's not necessarily out to make friends with his writing. He didn't mind who he offended. Can you talk about that attitude toward journalism?
Well, he believed, one of his favorite sort of aphorisms about newspapers was from Joseph Pulitzer, which is, a newspaper should have no friends. Alexander had a lot of friends, but he didn't think that, back-scratching was part of the agenda. He thought that he wrote it like he saw it. And so, if you read the book, you can see there's a lot of people he speaks, very commendably about. But when he caught someone out, he thought they were behaving badly, he said so.
He came at the world from a perspective, I think, loosely speaking, fairly speaking, on the left. We can talk about some labels people have tried to attach to him. That didn't mean he supported the Democratic Party in the United States or President Obama or President Clinton. Can you talk about what he thought about those two political figures?
Well, I think one of the very first times he read about Obama, he called him slithery. So from that, you can see what he thought about him. He just thought, he thought they were both from the same mold, ambitious fellows who were prepared to, who got themselves elected were on a sort of left agenda. If you remember Obama's 28 campaign, it was actually pretty, very progressive and, inspired so many people, especially young people. And then when he got in, as Alexander had predicted, he immediately, hires basically the upper tier of Citibank to Citicorp to run the economic front, people chosen by Robert Rubin, and pursued as now many people I think would now agree, pursued a very, well, let's be polite and call it conservative centrist agenda, and really the same with Clinton. I mean, just think about Clinton's welfare so-called reform. I mean, I don't want to spend all your time discussing all that, but I'm just saying that Alexander saw them as having betrayed, you know, the principles, the professed principles on what they got elected, and that's why he wrote the way he did.
You challenge a couple of labels in your foreword to the book that people put on Alexander. People called him un-American or anti-American. You, right off the bat, don't buy that.
Absolutely not. Alexander loved America. He spent a large part of his life, you know, living in England and Ireland, where we grew up. But this was the country in where he was happy that he adopted. He became a citizen, became an American. And actually, he knew the place incredibly well. What he really liked to do was to get in one of the many fairly decrepit classic cars that he collected over the years. I think he left 10 when he died. And drive around the country, you know, to nooks and crannies that, you know, most people would never hear of, let alone visit. And in fact, one of his closest friends was a classic Chrysler dealer in near Spartanburg, South Carolina, Dave Eller. And Alexander would, you know, go to Dave and pick up yet another something on which he'd set his heart, you know, 62 Chrysler Imperial or something, and drive it back across the country with many encounters with AAA men and speed cops and other interesting aspects of the fauna along the way.
He'd challenge the highway patrol sometimes. I think I read that this car was not physically capable of going as fast as they claimed to have clocked him.
Well, that's right. I think that was the 64 Newport that spent 6 years in a field, and birds had built nests in it. So I was amazed it went anywhere but downhill, but still he got it on the road.
Another label you challenge is the idea of calling him a contrarian. He definitely has a contrary perspective. Why can't we call him a contrarian as a journalist?
It's not so much. It's my irritation of the actual word. I think it implies people who call themselves contrarians. It's just like being contrary to something just for the sake of being contrary, which wasn't his attitude at all. He didn't, and unlike some people we could mention, he didn't sort of try and, you know, get publicity or promote himself by being, oh, the person who always took the opposite side. People call him that because he took some positions that, you know, surprised people. He didn't sort of fit, you know, he didn't sort of get up in the morning and put on the uniform of, you know, your standard left, you know, liberal left commentator, you know, complete with, you know, cap and boots and bell and whistle. He, as I said at the beginning, he called it like he saw it. So, for example, he was he frequently wrote about the Fully Informed Jury Association, which is actually considered normally a sort of right-wing, almost a sort of, you know, very right-wing cause, you know, the traditional American belief that a jury can do what it wants without being bossed around by judges and lawyers. Now, that's, you know, that fits into the right-wing slot, and yet he believed in it and said so. There were many examples like that.
Well, though coming from the left, he saw things to like in the conservative populist movement in this country.
He did. I mean, I've just mentioned one, but he liked the sort of state, you know, exactly the conservative populist tradition in this country. And he had a pretty keen nose for liberal hypocrisy. I mean, for example, if you look through the book, I think there are frequent sallies against the eugenicists, you know, people who, you know, the big promoters of eugenics earlier in the 20th century in America, who were all liberals, a fact he never failed to point out. So, I mean, you might think on a superficial, you know, take that he had a sort of very zigzag political perspective, but actually it's a very straight line. I mean, he was for us against them. He's for the people. He was against the imposition of big money, nanny state, you know, dominant authoritarian government in whatever form it took. So actually, I always regard Alexander as having pursued a very undeviating course, actually, throughout his, certainly all the time he lived here.
If people working in the mainstream media or independent journalism were to take home a lesson or two from your brother, what would you say they should take with them?
Be honest. Don't, always look for, always look for what they're really saying. don't follow sort of, you know, the party lines, because they'll certainly take you on an undulating course. I think, you know, stick up for what is right. That sounds kind of trite and pat, but it's, you know, if you look at the mainstream media, you find a lot of cases where that, you know, that doesn't happen.
Do you think we need more journalism from a perspective as opposed to an attempt at balanced or neutral reporting?
Well, let's, you know, I think everyone should try and be, you know, balanced or neutral. But I mean, that's, but at the same time, you admit everything is from perspective. I mean, you know, there's no such thing as, you know, completely, I mean, it's a myth and a fiction that there are such things as unbiased reporters. I mean, you should differentiate that from honest reporting. I mean, we should all be honest in our reporting and, you know, get the facts right and, you know, be fair in presenting, you know, whatever facts are relevant. But to say, you know, oh, I'm absolutely unbiased, like, say, the New York Times does, when it clearly isn't, I think, it, you know, is a hypocrisy and should be avoided at all costs, which Alexander certainly did and urged others so to behave.
Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, you're welcome.
That was Andrew Coburn. He's a journalist, author, brother of the late Alexander Coburn. Alexander's last book is A Colossal Wreck, A Road Trip Through Political Scandal, Corruption, and American Culture.